I'm Kara Swisher, and you're listening to Sway. My guest today is Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot. In 2019, she became the first Black woman and first openly gay person to hold that position, winning 74% of the vote and sweeping all 50 wards. It was Lightfoot's first run for elected office, and she used that to her advantage, campaigning as a reformer who would challenge the power of the Chicago political machine. Since her win, Lightfoot has emerged as a lightning rod. She's dealt with criticism from the establishment and from the press as she leads Chicago in addressing many of the thorny issues the whole country is grappling with, from inequality and economic recovery to crime and police reform. So I wanted to talk to her about how she thinks about her priorities and about her critics. Mayor Lightfoot, welcome. Thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure.
So you came to office, as I said, in May of 2019. You're now 2 years in, just halfway through your first term. Tell me what you think your biggest win and your biggest, I guess, loss has been.
Well, I think that we have already taken some pretty important steps to break up a status quo that was really holding people back. Unfortunately, we are a very segregated city. The north side is overwhelmingly white, west and south sides, Black and brown. So we committed $750 million city dollars towards investing in Black and brown neighborhoods with the idea that we raise well over $1 billion in economic investment. And even through the pandemic year, we pushed $70 million out into 10 communities, 12 different commercial corridors, and we attracted $300 million additional dollars through private investment and philanthropic investment in these communities. You know, when I came into office, a lot of people were like, we don't know this Lightfoot woman. She doesn't seem to understand business. She doesn't seem to understand this and that. I mean, those are very common tropes thrown against women, people of color. But what I do know is that if our city doesn't grow by investing in neighborhoods that have been long ignored, all of the challenges of violence, healthcare disparities, life expectancy, those will continue to deepen. I think the biggest challenge, obviously, that we face is the pandemic. There absolutely is no playbook for that. I don't know that of any mayor, and I speak regularly with my peers across the country, who was prepared to deal with the incredibly difficult, nuanced challenges. And then on top of that, the huge economic meltdown, coupled with massive civic unrest, an important focus on systemic racism, all of those things being compressed together in about 6 months' time, that was a huge, huge challenge.
What about yourself? I agree, these are all like massive challenges, but what do you imagine for yourself that you would do differently? You've been criticized for your adversarial style. One June 2021 article in the Chicago Sun-Times quoted a source saying, Rahm Emanuel was abrasive, but if he's sandpaper, Lori Lightfoot is a belt sander. I've read so many pieces in the different publications in Chicago about tensions. Obviously, I know you don't read the Chicago Tribune or you've gotten rid of your subscription. They called you irascible at one point. And you've noticed, you're laughing. I've been called irascible, so I get that. female leaders get that all the time.
Yeah.
Some of it is fair and some of it is not, obviously. Do you think there's any truth to this criticism in your case?
Yeah, you know, I don't take that criticism with a whole lot of seriousness. Mm-hmm. Look, I came into office to push people out of their comfort zone. And I've done that. And I will continue to do that unapologetically. And a lot of people don't think that's women's place. A lot of people don't think it's a person of color's place. I think I get less pushback because of my sexual orientation, but roll it all up. I'm Black, I'm female, I'm a lesbian. Mm-hmm. And no one expected me to win. And early on, after I was elected, a lot of people came to me trying to cut the same old kind of deals, the backroom mm-hmm. stuff. And I'm like, no, that's not who I am. And they're like, wait, you actually meant that, what mm-hmm. you said on the campaign trail? I'm like, yes, I did. And yeah, I'm tough. There's no question about it. You don't get to be a Black woman going to the places that I've been, whether it's a federal prosecutor, whether it's a senior equity partner at one of the largest law firms in the world, by letting people walk all over you mm-hmm. and not fighting for your place at the table. Does that make some people angry and upset? It does. But I'm not going to apologize for being an advocate for the things that I think are really important for mm-hmm. our city.
I mean, it's not only white guys that are attacking you, obviously. I want to move on to COVID and things like that, but I want to get a sense of it because one of the things I just, you know, I had thought about running for mayor and I thought my difficult personality was going to be a problem. And I don't want to use the word difficult. I'm a tough person too. Do you imagine changing your style at all?
I think it's interesting that two women are talking about style.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I have my opinions about that.
Well, tell me.
Well, I wonder if we'd be having this conversation if I was a man. I really
well,
do.
I did talk to Rahm Emanuel about his difficult manner and his abrasive style.
But here's what I would say is this. It's not about the style, mm-hmm. because that's just, to me, a sexist trope.
Sure.
What's important is building the relationship and getting stuff done. If the way in which I handled my business as mayor prevented me from getting things done for our residents, then I would say, yeah, of course we need to reevaluate that. But here's the thing. You know, we had the kind of Hallmark card 2-year anniversary, and my team sat down and put together all the things that we were able to accomplish over 2 short years, one of which was a pandemic year. And we came up with 150 substantive accomplishments, whether it's the amount of resources that we put into traditionally neglected communities, whether it's the support that we've given to small businesses, obviously all the things that we did through the pandemic. If I was everything that I've been described in the papers, I couldn't get anything done. I came into office knowing very few city council members. And with the exception of one or two, most of them never talked to me, never met me, and certainly didn't support me. So building a series of partnerships and relationships to get things done on behalf of the city, I think I've got a record of accomplishment that's very important.
I know you called it a Hallmark moment, your 2-year anniversary, which is funny. I think that was, you're right. I think we try to say what's happened in a year, what happened, but it is a way people keep track of things. Would you imagine the next 2 years, what's happening for you?
Well, I think we're deep into it. And we really started laying the foundation for that a year ago. You know, COVID is still real. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to still be dealing with COVID issues for the foreseeable future. But we're also going to be dealing with an economic recovery and making sure that that truly is equitable and inclusive. Those aren't just nice words to me. When you don't invest in human capital, when you don't invest in neighborhoods, that manifests itself in real, tangible issues, which we saw flashing like a neon sign through COVID, like life expectancy gaps, like an incredible mistrust of government, not having connections to the healthcare system, seeing people really disappear in our educational system, in part because some of our young people had to get jobs to take care of their families. And when you see communities that are bereft of the kind of amenities and resources that many of us take for granted, it manifests itself not only in the things that I've listed, but also in violence.
All right, let's get to the pandemic. The Delta variant is now on the rise again. Los Angeles has become the first major county to restore mask mandates indoors. LA County's vaccination rate is similar to yours. About 70% of adults have received at least one dose. Is Chicago considering reinstating a mask mandate?
We're not there yet, but I am very concerned about what we're seeing in the uptick in our cases. We're still in a good place as we are speaking, but we're seeing an uptick in daily cases. We're starting to see a slight uptick in hospitalizations. You know, the deaths are kind of a trailing indicator. That's steady for now. But when I see statistics like 97% of the people that are getting sick or 97% of the people that are dying are folks who are unvaccinated, that is alarming. The southern part of our state is starting to really catch fire with new COVID infections. I'm worried about a surge there. So I'm concerned. We're sounding the alarm. And we're going to be looking closely at how the data progresses.
So what is the threshold for a mask mandate for you?
Well, look, if we get back into an area where we feel like we're in a red zone, which we are working very hard to make sure that our daily case rate is below 200, if we start to see consistently going over that, we're not only going to look at a mask mandate, but we're going to look back at other tools that we've been compelled to use. I hope we don't get there. Mm-hmm. What we're going to keep focusing on is pushing vaccine. But my number one priority is to keep people safe.
So what are you doing to get your vaccine rates up, especially with the urgency of the Delta variant? What are the pushbacks and obstacles you're seeing in Chicago specifically?
We've been at this now since December. The appetite for vaccines has definitely waned. We're seeing that all over the country. Some mass vaccination sites aren't nearly as effective as they were, say, February, April, where people were scrambling to get it. What we are seeing is more effective is smaller, concentrated efforts. We literally have teams of people going door to door in those zip codes where we see the lowest uptick in vaccines. In my city, the South Side, which is majority Black, and particular neighborhoods, we're way under 40% vaccine uptake. And not that long ago, we were only in the high teens, low 20s. That's a crisis in my mind. So really drilling down, using local ambassadors, going door to door, really trying to answer people's concerns and fears. People are afraid. They are concerned about how the speed at which the vaccines came into fruition. And we're just trying to get people to engage in an honest conversation around what their fears are, try to answer them with the data and the science, and really using people within their networks who have been vaccinated as a kind of proof point for them that the vaccine is safe.
In those communities, what do you find the biggest reason for not? I mean, President Biden just made news talking about social media killing people. He sort of walked it back a little bit. What did you think of President Biden's comment about Facebook and others?
Well, how much time do you have?
We have plenty of time. If you have it, look, we have it.
Yeah, look, I am deeply concerned about the level of toxicity that exists on these social media platforms. And obviously, I have my own experience with it. People saying all sorts of homophobic, racist, violent things unchecked. And I know that not only from my experience, but from mayors across the country. Just things that are allowed to breed and fester on social media are horrendous. I worry about our democracy, and I mean that in all seriousness. I worry about this generation of young people growing up and thinking that being the biggest irritant on social media, demonizing someone else that you don't agree with or who doesn't agree with you, that's not what democracy is about. You've got to build a bridge for people to travel over to you and you to them. And I think social media, to say essentially, hey, we're hands off, we're just a public square, that's nonsense. This is a bazillion dollar industry that is profiting from allowing people to use their platforms. That's not acceptable.
Okay. So speaking of which, you just went on a trip to San Francisco as part of an effort to build tech community in Chicago. Obviously, Groupon had been there, and there's several well-known entrepreneurs there. Eric Lefkowski is doing Tempest there and things like that. So why did you go there? I mean, what's your goal? Because this is where this came from.
Yeah, it's kind of a multi-tiered strategy. Number one, we have a tier one tech community here in Chicago that it's important for us to let the rest of the world know about. The pandemic, I think, has really made people think about, well, where do I physically need to be able to explore what I want? Particularly in the tech community, it's no secret that people are reevaluating whether or not they need to be in San Francisco or Silicon Valley. We want to make sure that Chicago is top of mind. So a big part of the trip was educating folks on the coast, particularly venture capitalists, about the range of opportunities that exist here in Chicago. Also, we want to repatriate people from the Chicago area. For far too long, particularly our engineers, felt like the only way I can really make it in the tech world is to be in Silicon Valley or be in New York. That's not true anymore.
So this is something, obviously, Miami Mayor Francis Suarez was trying it, the Austin mayor, everything else. What was your particular pitch to them? Because, you know, you've had tech companies that have, you know, Groupon was a big shooting star. You have Grubhub and some others. And as I said, LightBank is there. But it's small compared to anywhere else. What is your biggest sale to these people?
Well, I think really educating beyond that about what the real opportunities are here. And it's not just the Groupons, which everybody knows, but we've got a huge, vibrant tech community from fintech to our transportation, distribution, logistics. We're, I think, number one in the country. We got a lot of tech that's serving that community. Life sciences, huge amount of tech servicing that community. So really deeply educating folks about the range of opportunities here, the diversity of the tech community, the supports that are here, 1871, P33. We've got a number of other incubators that are really producing incredible talent. People don't know that story. So telling that story is critically important.
Were the companies you were talking to worried about crime in Chicago? Did they voice concerns?
It came up, but I will tell you, it came up. It was not a huge topic of conversation, but I don't shy away from that. And I, when it didn't come up, I took it on right away. It's the elephant in the room. And I walked through with them, one, my commitment, why I believe it is the issue, not one of a number of priorities, but the issue. We've got a lot of great things that are going on in the city of Chicago. Great things. We've been very intentional about reopening the city and rebuilding our economy. But if people don't feel safe, nothing else matters.
Right, obviously. And already in 2021, there are more than 2,000 people have been shot and 400 people have been murdered. Why do you think this is happening in Chicago? Obviously, it's happening in cities and crime is rising across the country. Talk a bit about your plans to address this, because I think one of the things that people have in their mind from a national point of view is Chicago is a dangerous place. How do you address that?
So I think a couple of things. Look, in Chicago, but I think across the country, we're in this space where violent crime is a real issue. We see it certainly in New York, LA, St. Louis, Atlanta. It's a challenge all across the country. I'm happy to report that really starting in April and really took hold in June and so far in July, we're seeing a downward trend year over year in homicides and shootings, but no one is taking a victory lap, least of all me. We've got a lot more work to do. Why do I think that this is happening in this moment here in Chicago and perhaps also across the country? To me, all roads lead to COVID. When you think about public safety is really an ecosystem. Public safety isn't just cops on dots, meaning police officers occupying spaces in high crime areas across the city. Every part of that public safety ecosystem was crushed by COVID. Our county partners, the prosecutor, the courts, the jails similarly retreated. Our Cook County court system for criminal trials still hasn't fully reopened 16 months later.
So at some point, though, COVID, you can't hide. I don't say the word hide behind because I don't think that's what you're particularly doing. But crime has been a problem in Chicago pre-COVID.
Violent crime in 19 actually was down. We got under 500 homicides for the first time in a number of years. That was my first year in office. But everything got upended when we talk about COVID. Police reform is a totally different question. And yes, I think we've made progress. Have we, in 2 years and a couple of months, completely upended the apple cart and gotten everything that is necessary? No, of course not. But we've made progress. You're aware of the fact that the Chicago Police Department is under a consent decree, and we've made progress in meeting our obligations on the consent decree. Again, not good enough, but we're moving forward. We've done a lot on things that were truly harming people. For example, we've made progress on, and this is really important, foot pursuits. Foot pursuits are one of the most dangerous things for police, but also for the public. I raised this issue as a candidate, and now as mayor, we've done, I think, significant reforms because when you're running away from the police, regardless of what the circumstances are, and in many instances, there were non-felony matters. People run for a lot of reasons. I know that now in my city. You shouldn't result in a death or a shooting because you ran away from the police.
Adam Toledo was a 13-year-old.
But not just the Toledo shooting. This is a systemic problem going back many, many years, and we're putting controls on it.
Now, let me just be clear. You do not support defunding the police, correct?
No. In the environment that we're in, with violent crime and gun crimes in particular going up, it would be foolish for us to be defunding the police. And in Chicago, and I think this is true of most departments across the country, when you look at it, when you talk about defunding, 94% of the police budget is personnel. So if you're going to defund, you're cutting people. Mm-hmm. And when you're going to defund, given the vagaries of collective bargaining agreements, you're going to take the least experienced folks first. But they're also our most diverse people. So you're going to leave in place the more veteran officers who are less diverse, and you're going to cut the junior officers, but who are the most diverse. That makes no sense. That would set diversity inclusion back, I think, decades if we were to do that. So no, I don't support
it. What do you think of the defund movement and the power they're getting? Obviously, activists are pressuring you on that side. There's, and it's all across the country. It's not just in Chicago, this idea of doing this. What do you imagine is going to result from it? And how do you push back?
Well, here's what I hear when I hear defund. And I say here, it's based on a lot of conversations with a number of people. Now, there are some people who are true believers who really think, no, I really mean defund. I really mean eliminate police departments entirely. That is a very small, I think, minority opinion. I think what most people say and mean when they say defund is we're sick and tired of communities not getting a proportionate share of resources, investments in economic development, in jobs, in mental health, in schools, all the things that we know lead to healthy, vibrant communities. We want all of those things. And if the choice is police versus us, we want us to be supported. We want communities to be supported. I don't think it's a this or that. I think it's both and. And that's what we've tried to do over very difficult budgets. You know that I walked into office inheriting what was then a historic budget deficit. But despite that fact, we've put money into communities through economic development, supporting our young people, mental health, affordable housing. We've made investments around homelessness and more to come.
So you're in deep negotiations with the Chicago Police Union, the FOP, and the new contract, the one under, they're currently operating, expired 4 years ago. There's a recently, there's a recent hiccup in the negotiation with the union president saying that you were closing in on a deal and you coming out and saying that wasn't the case. So what happened there? Was the union trying to force your hand?
They're always trying to force my hand. I mean, that's just what they do.
Well, you're a lawyer, you know how that works.
Yeah, our biggest hiccup over now 2+ years since this new administration and FOP has been involved, is them facing the reality that police reform and accountability is not negotiable. People want a reform. They want accountability. And so do I. And I'm determined that we're going to deliver it. So why this has been protracted is the FOP president knew that the status quo that didn't have the kind of controls around it that predated my time as mayor was probably the best contract he was going to get regarding reform and accountability because it didn't really have any measures in it. But that's not reality. Luckily, our state legislature has also upped the ante by mandating certain reform measures as a matter of state law that can't be ignored. And so I think we will ultimately get there, but we're going to do it on a timeline that makes sense for our city, for our taxpayers, for the members.
So what does that mean? That's a lot of words I don't, what's specific?
How do you close the deal now? What it means is we need to make sure that the dollars that they propose make sense. We've obviously got to think about what are the revenue sources for that. And we're fly-specking all of the reform measures that we've advocated for to make sure that we've gotten everything that I know that we need to be able to move forward. We're doing our diligence.
You're doing our diligence. And the Civilian Review Board?
Well, we work very hard to bring this into reality. My goal was to make sure that we had meaningful oversight, that individuals had a real opportunity to participate in understanding and influencing one of the biggest parts of our budget, which is the Chicago Police Department. I think this is ultimately a good deal for the city, that it strikes the right balance and make sure that it maintains guardrails and controls around important things like budget, like policy, but also gives a real meaningful voice for civilian oversight. Striking that balance was very important to me.
Okay, but you want control as mayor, correct?
Well, hopefully there's going to be more collaboration than there's going to be conflict. This issue about control emanates from those who believe that there's perpetual conflict. I don't. There should be oversight. It should be meaningful. It should be real. Going into this thinking we're going to be at war with each other is the wrong mindset.
Okay. The White House recently announced Washington will send law enforcement strike forces to several cities, including Chicago, to help address gun trafficking. Now, when President Trump had talked about this, there was a lot of resistance. What is the difference?
It's the difference between night and day. Number one, what President Trump was proposing was to impose upon cities, and we saw that horrifically play out in Portland last summer. That's a recipe for disaster. I said to President Trump, and I sent him a letter, that there were some things that the federal government was uniquely qualified to do, low-hanging fruit that didn't require passing something through Congress, like the strike forces that President Biden has now embraced. We need multi-jurisdictional teams dealing in a proactive way on gun trafficking. The city of Chicago is awash in illegal firearms. They come over the border from Indiana, from Michigan, Wisconsin, and from southern states like Mississippi. The only way that we can proactively stem that tide is using federal resources, the U.S. attorneys, the ATF, DEA, FBI, working together across jurisdictions to share information and disrupt the supply chain for illegal firearms coming to Chicago. That was something that I advocated for, got no traction. We've gotten traction with the Biden administration.
We'll be back in a minute. If you like this interview and want to hear others, follow us on your favorite podcast app. You'll be able to catch up on Sway episodes you may have missed, like my conversation with Miami Mayor Francis Suarez, and you'll get new ones delivered directly to you. More with Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot after the break. Back in May, Mayor Lightfoot announced that on the occasion of the two-year anniversary of her inauguration, she would grant one-on-one interviews exclusively to journalists of color. She faced a lot of heat for it. How do you feel about the reaction to that? You're being sued. Some people, including prominent journalists of color, called it a stunt. Tell me why you did that. Why are you talking to me? Like, I'm a white lady.
So here's the bottom line for me. To state the obvious, I'm a Black woman mayor. I'm the mayor of the third largest city in the country. Obviously, have a platform. It's important to me to advocate on things that I believe are important. And going back to why I ran, to disrupt the status quo. The media is critically important to our democracy. You know this better than I do. The media is in a time of incredible upheaval and disruption. But our City Hall press corps looks like it's 1950 or 1970. When I look across the podium, whether I'm in a formal press conference or I'm out in a neighborhood, the reporters who show up are invariably overwhelmingly white. Intentionality around diversity and inclusion is crucial. People that make the hiring decisions have to be focused on diversity. In Chicago, we have a huge amount of diverse media talent. We've got schools that are of journalism that are best in class across the country, and I would say really across the world. So the absence of journalists of color covering the mayor of the third largest city in the country is absolutely unacceptable. And so I decided to say something about it.
You're talking about the mainstream media.
Correct.
I agree with you. I just taught at the University of Chicago. You have amazing diverse journalists studying there that I taught. And I agree with the need for more diversity in media, but politicians don't get to choose who covers them. Is there a different way to do this, talking to smaller
It's not about me choosing who covers me, right? I gave exclusive interviews, and we do get to choose who we talk to in exclusives. I gave exclusive interviews with journalists of color, right? One 24-hour period, and it was like people's heads exploded. I had journalists saying, does the mayor think I'm racist? No, it's not about individuals. It's about systemic racism. It's about calling it like I see it and challenging the heads of the media companies here in town to do a better job of bringing journalists of color, women, into the fray. That's what this is about. And so, yeah, I could have been quiet and sat back and said, well, I don't like this. I think they could do better. I kept it to myself. But why should I? If not me, who? I believe, a responsibility. These are issues that I care deeply about. And what I heard from most journalists of color, and particularly Black journalists, thank you, Mayor. We've been trying to have these conversations in our newsrooms, with our producers, with our presidents, and we couldn't get traction until now. And I've seen a difference.
So has it worked?
One of the business journals here.
Would you do it again?
I would absolutely do it again. I would absolutely do it again. I'm unapologetic about it because it spurred a very important conversation, a conversation that needed to happen, that should have happened a long time ago. But I don't want it just a conversation. I want results. I want to see these networks, these companies, these producers, the decision makers take this seriously. because it's a serious issue.
It, 100%.
As I said before, the media plays a very important role in our democracy. And if the only voices in the media are white guys, that's a problem. Because it, and again,
it covers tech, so I'm aware of this problem quite substantively.
Yeah, so I'm just saying we need to have a variety of voices bringing different perspectives to interpreting events of the day so that we have a balanced, diverse approach to issues. If we only have a perspective that doesn't share the lived experience of a city that's two-thirds people of color, that does a disservice to our city.
Mm-hmm. The question is whether it will work. I mean, I've been banging on this in tech, and it honestly hasn't worked. I'll tell you, in essence.
But if you're not diligent, if you don't keep banging on that door, change is never going to happen. It's too easy to say
no. That's a fair point. So I want to ask the last question. You're up for re-election in 2023. You obviously know this one's coming. Are you running again? You'd answered some rumors saying you were quitting and all kinds of stuff. Can you just answer that? They're out there. I like your laugh.
I think the politics will take care of themselves. We're in the middle of a crisis, still a pandemic, a crisis of violence. I'm not sitting here thinking about my reelection possibilities. I'll make that decision with my wife at an appropriate time, but it's not now.
How are you feeling about it? That was a very political response. You've learned something in your short time in elected office.
Well, I was a trial lawyer for 30
That's
years.
Fair.
So
that's fair. Because they're so subtle, trial lawyers. But go ahead.
Look, I feel like the politics, I really do feel like that the politics will take care of itself. If this was a different time and we had not been through, and I say we, I mean my wife and I, my family, but I also mean my team, hadn't been through what we've been through over this last year, it would be an easier question to answer. I still probably wouldn't answer it now, but it would be an easier question to answer. It's not a gimme. The toxicity of the debate, the physical and emotional toll that it's taking on all of us, those are serious issues. And we have to have my wife and I and my daughter and my close friends and my team, we have to have a serious conversation about why and what that would look like and what we believe that we would be able to accomplish. And could we even get it done? Right. This is a tough time for mayors all across the country.
Keisha Lance Bottoms.
You know that. There's a reason why there's been a slew of people saying, you know what? I'm good with one term.
Did you look at Keisha Lance Bottoms and others? There's a lot of people, you know, not continuing.
Well, look, I'm very good friends with Jenny Durkin. I'm very good friends with Keisha. I'm very good friends with a lot of other mayors who have to make this decision before I do, who are feeling like they're in a different place than they ever imagined they would be in.
Okay. I'm still not running for mayor now, I have to tell you, just thinking about it. Exhausted.
It's a tough time to be mayor. I mean, I've had a lot of people tell me, man, you got the worst job in the country, but I think I've got the best job. It's hard. It's a lot harder because of all the unforeseen circumstances that we've been through over the last 16 months, but I wouldn't trade any minute of it because, you know, every day I find something where we're helping people who haven't been helped before. And I live off of that all day long.
All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
No, my pleasure.
Sway is a production of New York Times Opinion. It's produced by Naeem Araza, Blakeney Schick, Caitlin O'Keefe, Matt Kwong, and Daphne Chen. Edited by Naeem Araza and Paula Schumann. With original music by Isaac Jones, mixing by Eric Gomez and Carol Saburo. Fact-checking by Kate Sinclair. Special thanks to Shannon Busta, Kristen Lin, and Liriel Higa. If you're in a podcast app already, you know how to get your podcasts, so follow this one. If you're listening on the Times website and want to get each new episode of Sway delivered to you, along with a deep dish pizza and an inside scoop of my mayoral ambitions, download any podcast app, then search for Sway and follow the show. We release every Monday and Thursday. Thanks for listening.